Rinaga must be shogun. To gift the empire onto Yeamon, to Lord Yeamon, the realm must be secured first. There'll never be another opportunity. His words trailed off. He squared his back, frightened because he had said it, glad that he had said publicly what he had been thinking forever. Toranaga sighed. I have never sought to become shogun. How many times do I have to say it? I support my nephew Yeamon and the Taiko's will. He looked at them all, one by one. Lastly at Naga. The youth winced. But Toranaga said kindly, calling him back to the lure. Your zeal and youth alone excuse you. Unfortunately, many much older and wiser than you think that's my ambition. It isn't. There's only one way to settle that nonsense, and that's put Lord Yeamon into power. And that I intend to do. Yes, father. Thank you. Thank you, Naga replied in despair. Toranaga shifted his eyes to Igarashi. What's your counsel? The one-eyed samurai scratched. Me? I'm only a soldier, not a counselor. But I wouldn't advise Crimson Sky. Not if we can war on our terms, like Omi-san says. I fought in Shinano years ago. That's bad country. And then Lord Zataki was with us. I wouldn't want a war in Shinano again, and never if Zataki was hostile. And if Lord Maeda's suspect, well, how can you plan a battle if your biggest ally may betray you? Lord Ishida will put 200,000-300,000 men against you, and still keep 100 holding Osaka. Even with the guns, we've not enough men to attack. But behind the mountains using the guns, you could hold out forever, if it happens like Omi-san says. We could hold the passes. You've enough rice? Doesn't the Kanto supply half the empire? Well, a third at least. And we could send you all the fish you need. You'd be safe. Let Lord Ishido and Devil Jikyu come at us if it's to happen like Omi-san said. That soon the enemy will be feeding on each other. If not, keep Crimson Sky ready. A man can die for his lord only once in this life. Has anyone anything to add? Toranaga asked. No one answered him. Mariko-san?
It's not my place to speak here, sir, she replied. I'm sure everything has been said that should have been said. But may I be allowed to ask for all your counselors here, what do you think will happen?
Toranaga chose his words deliberately. I believe that what Omi-san forecast will happen. With one exception, the council won't be impotent. The council will wield enough influence to gather an invisible allied force. When the rains cease, it will be thrown against the Kanto, bypassing Izu. The Kanto will be gobbled up, then Izu. Only after I'm dead will the daimyos fight among themselves.
But why, sire? Omi ventured.
Because I've too many enemies. I own the Kanto, I've warred for more than 40 years, and never lost a battle. They're all afraid of me. I know that first the vultures will pack together to destroy me. Later, they'll destroy themselves, but first they'll join to destroy me, if they can. Know very clearly, all of you, I'm the only real threat to Yeamon, even though I'm no threat at all. That's the irony of it. They all believe I want to be shogun. I don't. This is another war that's not necessary at all.
Naga broke the silence.
Then what are you going to do, sire? Eh? What are you going to do?
Obviously, Crimson Sky, Toranaga said.
But you said they'd eat us up.
They would, if I gave them any time. But I'm not going to give them any time.
We go to war at once.
But the rains? What about the rains?
We will arrive in Kyoto wet. Hot and stinking and wet. Surprise, mobility, audacity, and timing win wars, ne? Yabu-san was right. The guns will blast away through the mountains.
For an hour, they discussed plans and the feasibility of large-scale war in the rainy season, an unheard-of strategy. Then Toranaga sent them away, except Mariko, telling Naga to order the engine-san here. He watched them walk off. They had all been outwardly enthusiastic once the decision had been announced, Naga and Buntaro particularly. Only Omi had been reserved and thoughtful and unconvinced. Toranaga discounted Igarashi, for he knew that rightly, the soldier would do only what Yabu ordered, and he dismissed Yabu as a pawn. Treacherous, certainly, but still a pawn.
Omi's the only one worthwhile, he thought. I wonder if he's worked out yet what I'm really going to do. Mariko-san, find out tactfully how much the courtesan's contract would cost.
She blinked. Kiku-san, sir?
Yes.
Now, sir? At once?
Tonight would do excellently.
He looked at her blandly.
Her contract's not necessarily for me. Perhaps for one of my officers.
I would imagine the price would depend on whom, sire?
I imagine it will. But set a price. The girl, of course, has the right of refusal if she wishes, when the samurai's named. But tell her Mama-san Ona that I don't expect the girl will have the bad manners to mistrust my choice for her. Tell the owner also that Kiku is a lady of the first class of Mishima, and not Edo or Osaka or Kyoto.
Toranaga added genially.
So I expect to pay Mishima prices, and not Edo or Osaka or Kyoto prices.
Yes, sire, of course.
Toranaga moved his shoulder to ease the ache, shifting his swords.
May I massage it for you, sire? Or send for Suo?
No, thank you. I'll see Suo later.
Toranaga got up and relieved himself with great pleasure, then sat down again. He wore a short, light silk kimono, blue patterned, and the simple straw sandals. His fan was blue and decorated with his crest. The sun was low, rain clouds building heavily.
It's vast to be alive, he said happily. I can almost hear the rain waiting to be born.
Yes, she said.
Toranaga thought a moment. Then he said, as a poem,
the sky, scorched by the sun, weeps fecund tears.
Mariko obediently put her mind to work to play the poem game with him, so popular with most samurai, spontaneously twisting the words of the poem that he had made up, adapting them, making another from his. After a moment she replied, but the forest, wounded by the wind, weeps dead leaves.
Well said! Yes, very well said!
Toranaga looked at her contentedly, enjoying what he saw. She was dressed in a pale green kimono with patterns of bamboo, a dark green obi and orange sunshade. There was a marvellous sheen to the blue-black hair, which was piled high under her wide-brimmed hat. He remembered nostalgically how they had all, even the dictator Goroda himself, wanted her when she was 13, and her father, Akechi Jinsei, had first presented this, his eldest daughter, at Goroda's court. And how Nakamura, the taiko-to-be, had begged the dictator to give her to him. And then how Goroda had laughed and publicly called him his randy little monkey general and told him to
stick to fighting battles, peasant. Don't fight to stick patrician holes.
Akechi Jinsei had openly scorned Nakamura, his rival for Gorida's favor, the main reason why Nakamura had delighted in smashing him, and why also Nakamura had delighted in watching Buntaro squirm for years. Buntaro, who had been given the girl to cement an alliance between Gorida and Toda Hiromatsu.
I wonder, Toranaga asked himself mischievously, looking at her, I wonder if Buntaro were dead, would she consent to be one of my consorts?
Toranaga had always preferred experienced women, widows or divorced wives, but never too pretty or too wise or too young or too well-born, so never too much trouble and always grateful.
He chuckled to himself.
I'd never ask her, because she's everything I don't want in a consort. Except that her age is perfect.
Sire? She asked.
I was thinking about your poem, Mariko-san, he said, even more blandly. Then added, Why so wintry? Summer's yet to come, and the fall of glorious autumn.
She said in answer, If I could use words like falling leaves, what a bonfire my poems would make. He laughed and bowed with mock humility.
I concede victory, Mariko-sama. What will the favor be? A fan? Or a scarf for your hair?
Thank you, sir, she replied. Yes, whatever pleases you.
10,000 koku yearly to your son.
Oh, sire, we don't deserve such favor.
You won a victory. Victory and duty must be rewarded. How old is Saruji now?
15. Almost 15.
Ah, yes. He was betrothed to one of Lord Kiyama's granddaughters recently, wasn't he?
Yes, sir. It was in the 11th month last year, the month of the White Frost. He's presently at Osaka with Lord Kiyama.
Good. 10,000 koku, beginning at once. I will send the authority with tomorrow's mail. Now, enough of poems. Please give me your opinion.
My opinion, sire, is that we are all safe in your hands, as the land is safe in your hands.
I want you to be serious.
Oh, but I am, sire. I thank you for the favor to my son. That makes everything perfect. I believe whatever you do will be right. By the Madonna... Yes, by the Madonna. I swear I believe that.
Good. But I still want your opinion.
Immediately she replied, without a care in the world, as an equal to an equal. First, you should bring Lord Zatakiyo secretly back to your side. I'd surmise you either know how to do this already, or, more probably, you have a secret agreement with your half-brother, and you prompted his mythical defection in the first place to lull Ishido into a false position. Next, you'll never attack first. You never have. You've always counseled patience, and you only attack when you're sure to win. So publicly ordering Crimson Sky at once is only another diversion. Next, timing. My opinion is you should do what you will do, pretend to order Crimson Sky, but never commit it. This will throw Ishido into confusion, because, obviously, spies here and in Edo will report your plan, and he'll have to scatter his force like a covey of partridge. In filthy weather, to prepare for a threat that'll never materialize. Meanwhile, you'll spend the next 2 months gathering allies to undermine Ishido's alliances and break up his coalition, which you must do by any means. And, of course, you must tempt Ishido out of Osaka Castle. If you don't, sir, he will win, or at least you will lose the shogunate. You?
I've already made my position clear on that.
Toranaga rapped, no longer amused.
And you forget yourself.
Mariko said carelessly and happily, I have to talk secrets today, sire, because of the hostages. They're a knife in your heart.
What about them?
Be patient with me, please, sire. I may never be able to talk to you in what the Anjin-san would call an open English private way, ever again.
You're never alone like we're alone now. I beg you to excuse my bad manners.
Mariko gathered her wits, understandingly continued to speak as an equal. My absolute opinion is that Naga-san was right. You must become shogun, or you will have failed in your duty to the Empire and to the Minowara.
How dare you say such a thing?
Mariko remained quite serene, his open anger touching her not at all. I counsel you to marry the Lady Ochiba. It's 8 years before Yeomon's old enough, legally, to inherit. That's an eternity. Who knows what could happen in 8 months, let alone 8 years?
Your whole family can be obliterated in 8 days,
Yes, sire. But that has nothing to do with you and your duty and the realm. Naga-san's right. You must take the power to give power.
With mock gravity, she added breathlessly,
And now, may your faithful counselor commit seppuku, or should I do it later?
And she pretended to swoon. Toranaga gawked at her incredible effrontery. Then he roared with laughter and pounded his fist on the ground. When he could talk, he choked out,
I'll never understand you, Mariko-san.
Ah, but you do, sire, she said, patting the perspiration off her forehead. You're kind to let this devoted vassal make you laugh, to listen to her requests, to say what must be said, had to be said. Forgive me my impertinence, please.
Why should I, eh? Why?
Toranaga smiled, genial now.
Because of the hostages, sire, she said simply.
Ah, them.
He too became serious.
Yes. I must go to Osaka.
Yes, he said. I know.
Chapter 38. Accompanied by Naga, Blackthorn trudged disconsolately down the hill toward the two figures who sat on the futons in the center of the ring of guards. Beyond the guards were the rising foothills of the mountains that soared to a clouded sky. The day was sultry. His head was aching from the grief of the last few days, from worrying about Mariko, and from being unable to talk except in Japanese for so long. Now he recognized her, and some of his misery left him. Many times he had gone to Omi's house to see Mariko or to inquire about her. Samurai had always turned him away, politely but firmly. Omi had told him as a tomodachi, a friend, that she was all right.
Don't worry, Anjin-san. Do you understand?
Yes, he had said, understanding only that he could not see her. Then he had been sent for by Toranaga, and had wanted to tell him so much, but because of his lack of words, had failed to do anything other than irritate him. Fujiko had gone several times to see Mariko. When she came back, she always said that Mariko was well, adding the inevitable,
Shinpai suruna, Anjin-san, wakarimasu?
Don't worry. Do you understand? With Buntaro, it had been as though nothing had ever happened. They mouthed polite greetings when they met during the day. Apart from occasionally using the bathhouse, Buntaro was like any other samurai in Anjiro, neither friendly nor unfriendly. From dawn to dusk, Blackthorn had been chased by the accelerated training. He had had to suppress his frustration as he tried to teach and strove to learn the language. By nightfall, he was always exhausted. Hot and sweating and rain-soaked. And alone. Never had he felt so alone, so aware of not belonging in this alien world. Then there was the horror that began 3 days ago. It had been a very long, humid day. At sunset, he had wearily ridden home and had instantly felt trouble permeating his house. Fujiko had greeted him nervously.
Nen desu ka?
She had replied quietly, at length, eyes lowered.
Wakarimasen.
I don't understand.
Nan desu ka?
He asked again, impatiently, his fatigue making him irritable. Then she had beckoned him into the garden. She pointed at the eaves, but the roof seemed sound enough to him. More words and signs, and it finally dawned on him that she was pointing to where he had hung the pheasant.
Oh, I'd forgotten about that. Watashi.
But he couldn't remember how to say it. So he just shrugged wearily.
Wakarimasu. Nan desu kiji ka?
I understand. What about the pheasant? Servants were peering at him from doors and windows, clearly petrified. She spoke again. He concentrated, but her words did not make sense.
Wakarimasen, Fujiko-san.
I don't understand, Fujiko-san. She took a deep breath, then shakily imitated someone removing the pheasant, carrying it away, and burying it.
Ah! Wakarimasu, Fujiko-san. Wakarimasu! Was it getting high?
He asked. As he did not know the Japanese word, he held his nose and pantomimed stench.
Hai, Anjin-san. Those are Gorm and the Sai. Gorm and the Sai.
She made the sound of flies, and with her hands painted a picture of a buzzing cloud.
Ah, so des. Wakarimasu.
Once upon a time he would have apologized, and if he'd known the words, he would have said,
I'm so sorry for the inconvenience.
Instead, he just shrugged, eased the ache in his back, and mumbled,
Shigata ga nai,
wanting only to slide into the ecstasy of the bath and massage, the only joy that made life possible.
The hell with it, he said in English, turning away. If I'd been here during the day, I'd have noticed it. The hell with it.
Dozo, Anjin-san?
Shigata ga nai, he repeated louder.
Ah, so des. Arigato gozaimashita.
Dare toru desu ka?
Who took it?
Oekiya.
Oh, that old bugger.
Oekiya, the gardener, the kind, toothless old man who tended the plants with loving hands and made his garden beautiful.
Yoi. What they could do, Oekiya.
Good. Fetch him. Ujuko shook her head. Her face had become chalky white.
Oekiya. Shinda desu. Shinda desu.
She whispered.
Oekiya ga shindato? Dono yoni? Doshite? Doshite shindano da?
How? Why? How did he die? Her hand pointed at the place where the pheasant had been, and she spoke many gentle, incomprehensible words. Then she mimed the single cut of a sword.
Jesus Christ, God! You put that old man to death over a stinking God-cursed pheasant?
At once all the servants rushed to the garden and fell on their knees. They put their hands into the dirt and froze, even the children of the cook.
What the piss hell's going on?
Blackthorn was almost berserk. Ujiko waited stoically until they were all there, then she too went down on her knees and bowed, as a samurai and not as a peasant.
Gomenasai! Doso gomena!
The pox on your gomenasai! What right have you to do that? Hey!
And he began to swear at her foully.
Why in the name of Christ didn't you ask me first? Hey!
He fought for control, aware that all of his servants knew he legally could hack Ujiko and all of them to pieces here in the garden for causing him so much displeasure, or for no reason at all, and that not even Torunaga himself could interfere with his handling of his own household. He saw one of the children was trembling with terror and panic.
Jesus Christ in heaven! Give me strength!
He held onto one of the posts to steady himself.
It's not your fault!
He choked out, not realizing he wasn't speaking Japanese.
It's hers! It's you! You murdering bitch!
Ujiko looked up slowly. She saw the accusing finger and the hatred on his face. She whispered a command to her maid, Nigatsu. Nigatsu shook her head and began to beg.
Ima!
The maid fled. She returned with the killing sword, tears streaming her face. Ujiko took the sword and offered it to Blackthorn with both hands. She spoke, and though he did not know all the words, he knew that she was saying,
I'm responsible. Please take my life. Because I've displeasured you.
Iye!
He grabbed the sword and threw it away.
You think that'll bring Oekiya back to life?
Then, suddenly, he realized what he had done and what he was doing now.
Oh, Jesus God!
He left them. In despair, he went to the outcrop above the village near the shrine that was beside the ancient gnarled cypress tree, and he wept. He wept because a good man was dead unnecessarily, and because he knew now that he had murdered him.
Lord God, forgive me. I'm responsible, not Ujiko. I killed him. I ordered that no one was to touch the pheasant but me. I asked her if everyone understood. She said yes. I ordered it with mock gravity. But that doesn't matter now. I gave the orders, knowing their law and knowing their customs. The old man broke my stupid order. So what else could Ujiko-san do?
I'm to blame.
In time, the tears were spent. It was deep night now. He returned to his house. Ujiko was waiting for him as always, but alone. The sword was across her lap. She offered it to him.
Dozo. Dozo, Anjin-san.
Iye, he said, taking the sword as a sword should be taken. Iye, Ujiko-san. Shigata ga nai, ne? Kama, ne? His hand touched her in apology. He knew that she had had to bear all the worst of his stupidity. Her tears spilled.
Arigato. Arigato gozaimashita, Anjin-san,
she said brokenly.
Gomen nasai.
His heart went out to her. Yes, Blackthorn thought with great sadness. Yes, it did. But that doesn't excuse you, or take away her humiliation, or bring Yuikiya back to life. You were to blame. You should have known better.
Anjin-san, Naga said.
Yes? Yes, Naga-san?
He pulled himself out of his remorse and looked down at the youth, who walked beside him.
Sorry, what you say?
I said, I hoped to be your friend.
Ah, thank you.
Yes, and perhaps you'd...
There was a jumble of words Blackthorn did not understand.
Please? Teach, ne? Understand? Teach? Teach about world? Ah, yes, so sorry. Teach what, please? About foreign lands. Outside lands. The world, ne? Ah, understand now. Yes, try.
They were near the guards now.
Begin tomorrow, Anjin-san.
Friends, ne?
Yes, Naga-san. Try.
Good.
Very satisfied, Naga nodded. When they came up to the samurai, Naga ordered them out of the way, motioning Blackthorn to go on alone. He obeyed, feeling very alone in the circle of men.
Ohayo, Toranaga-sama. Ohayo, Mariko-san, he said, joining them. Ohayo, Anjin-san. Dozo suwaru.
Good day, Anjin-san. Please sit down. Mariko smiled at him.
Ohayo, Anjin-san. Ikaga desu ka?
Yoi, domo.
Blackthorn looked back at her, so glad to see her.
Thy presence fills me with joy, great joy, he said in Latin.
And thine, it is so good to see thee. But there is a shadow on thee. Why?
Nandra?
Toranaga asked. She told him what had been said. Toranaga grunted, then spoke.
My master says you're looking careworn, Anjin-san.
I must agree, too.
He asks, what's troubling you?
It's nothing. Domo, Toranaga-sama. Nani mo.
It's nothing.
Nanja?
Toranaga asked directly.
Nanja?
Obediently, Blackthorn replied at once.
Yuikiya, he said helplessly. Hai, Yuikiya. Ah, so des.
Toranaga spoke at length to Mariko.
My master says there is no need to be sad about old gardener. He asked me to tell you that it was all officially dealt with. Old Gardner understood completely what he was doing.
I don't understand.
Yes, it would be very difficult for you. But you see, Anjin-san, the pheasant was rotting in the sun. Flies were swarming terribly. Your health, your consort's health, and that of your whole house was being threatened. Also, so sorry, there had been some very private, cautious complaints from Omi-san's head servant, and others. One of our most important rules is that the individual may never disturb the wa, the harmony of the group, remember? So something had to be done. You see, decay, the stench of decay, is revolting to us. It's the worst smell in the world to us, so sorry. I tried to tell you, but, well, it's one of the things that sends us all a little mad. Your head servant...
Why didn't someone come to me at once? Why didn't someone just tell me?
Blackthorn asked.
The pheasant was meaningless to me. What was there to tell? You'd given orders. You are head of the house. They didn't know your customs or what to do, other than to solve the dilemma according to our custom.
She spoke to Toranaga for a moment, explaining what Blackthorn had said, then turned back again.
Is this distressing you? Do you wish me to continue?
Yes, please, Mariko-san.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Well, then your head servant, Small Tooth Cook, called a meeting of your servants, Anjin-san. Mura, the village headman, was asked to attend officially. It was decided that village Etta could not be asked to take it away. This was only a house problem. One of the servants had to take it and bury it, even though you'd given absolute orders it was not to be moved. Obviously, your consort was duty-bound to see your orders were obeyed. Old Gardner asked to be allowed to carry it away. Lately he'd been living and sleeping in great pain from his abdomen, and he found kneeling and weeding and planting very tiring, and could not do his work to his own satisfaction. Third cook assistant also offered, saying he was very young and stupid, and he was sure his life counted for nothing against such a grave matter. At length, old Gardner was allowed the honour. Truly, it was a great honour, Anjin-san. With great solemnity, they all bowed to him, and he to them, and happily he took the thing away and buried it to the great relief of all. When he came back, he went directly to Hujiko-san and told her what he had done, that he had disobeyed your law, ne? She had thanked him for removing the hazard, then told him to wait. She came to me for advice and asked me what she should do. The matter had been done formally, so it would have to be dealt with formally. I told her I didn't know, Anjin-san. I asked Buntaro-san, but he didn't know either. It was complicated because of you. So he asked Lord Toranaga. Lord Toranaga saw your consort himself.
Mariko turned back to Toranaga and told him where she had reached in the story, as he had requested. Toranaga spoke rapidly. Blackthorn watched them, the woman so petite and lovely and attentive, the man compact, rock-hard, his sash tight over his large belly. Toranaga did not talk with his hands like many, but kept them still, his left hand propped on his thigh, the other always on his sword hilt.
Hai, Toranaga-sama, hai!
Mariko glanced at Blackthorn and continued as formally.
Our master asked me to explain that, so sorry, if you'd been Japanese, there would have been no difficulty, Anjin-san. Old Gardner would simply have gone to the burial ground to receive his release. But, please excuse me, you're a foreigner, even though Lord Toranaga made you Hatamoto, one of his personal vassals, and it was a matter of deciding whether you were legally samurai or not. I'm honored to tell you that he ruled you are samurai, and you do have samurai rights. So everything was resolved at once and made easy. A crime had been committed. Your orders had been deliberately disobeyed. The law is clear. There is no option.
She was grave now.
But Lord Toranaga knows of your sensitivity to killing. So to save you pain, he personally ordered one of his samurai to send old Gardner into the void.
But why didn't someone ask me first? That pheasant meant nothing to me.
The pheasant has nothing to do with it, Anjin-san, she explained. You're head of a house. The law says no member of your house may disobey you. Old Gardner deliberately broke the law. The whole world would fall to pieces if people were allowed to flout the law. You're...
Toranaga broke in and spoke to her. She listened, answered some questions, then again he motioned her to continue.
Hai. Lord Toranaga wants me to assure you that he personally saw that old Gardner got the quick, painless and honourable death he merited. He even loaned the samurai his own sword, which is very sharp. And I should tell you that old Gardner was very proud that in his failing days he was able to help your house, Anjin-san. Proud that he helped to establish your samurai status before all. Most of all, he was proud of the honour being paid to him. Public executioners were not used, Anjin-san. Lord Toranaga wants me to make that very clear to you.
Thank you, Mariko-san. Thank you for making it clear.
Blackthorn turned to Torinaga, bowed most correctly.
Domo, Torinaga-sama. Domo arigato. Wakarimasu. Domo.
Torinaga bowed back agreeably.
Yoi, Anjin-san. Shinpai sudo mono ja nai, ne? Shigato ga nai, ne?
Good. Now don't worry, eh?
What could you do, eh? Nani mo.
Nothing. Blackthorn answered the questions Torinaga put to him about the musket training, but nothing that they were saying reached him. His mind was tottering under the impact of what he had been told. He had abused Hujiko before all his servants, and abused the trust of all his household, when Hujiko had done only what was correct, and so had they.
Hujiko was blameless. They're all blameless. Except me. I cannot undo what's been done. Neither to Yoekiya, nor to her, or to them. How can I live with this shame?
He sat cross-legged in front of Torinaga, the slight sea breeze tugging at his kimono, swords in his sash. Dully he listened and answered, and nothing was important.
War is coming, she was saying.
When?
He was asking.
Very soon, she was saying. So you are to leave at once with me. You are to accompany me part of the way, Anjin-san, because I'm going to Osaka, but you're going on to Edo by land to prepare your ship for war.
Suddenly the silence was colossal. Then the earth began to shake. He felt his lungs about to burst, and every fiber of his being screamed panic. He tried to stand, but could not, and saw all the guards were equally helpless. Torinaga and Mariko desperately held onto the ground with their hands and feet. The rumbling, catastrophic roar was coming from earth and sky. It surrounded them, building and building, until their eardrums were ready to split. They became part of the frenzy. For an instant, the frenzy stopped, the shock continuing. He felt his vomit rising, his unbelieving mind shrieking that this was land where it was firm and safe, and not sea where the world tilted every moment. He spat to clear the foul taste away, clutching the trembling earth. Retching again and again. An avalanche of rocks started from the mountain to the north and howled down into the valley below, adding to the tumult. Part of the samurai camp vanished. He groped to his hands and knees, Torinaga and Mariko doing the same. He heard himself shouting, but no sound seemed to be coming from his lips or from theirs. The tremor stopped. The earth was firm again, firm as it had always been. Firm as it always should be. His hands and knees and body were trembling uncontrollably. He tried to still them and catch his breath. Then again the earth cried out. The second quake began. It was more violent. Then the earth ripped open at the far end of the plateau. This gaping fissure rushed toward them at an incredible speed, passed 5 paces away, and tore onward. His disbelieving eyes saw Torinaga and Mariko teetering on the brink of the cleft, where there should have been solid ground. As though in a nightmare, he saw Torinaga, nearest to the moor, begin to topple into it. He came out of his stupor, lunged forward. His right hand grabbed Torinaga's sash, the earth trembling like a leaf in the wind. The cleft was 20 paces deep and 10 across, and stank of death. Mud and rocks poured down, dragging Torinaga and him with it. Blackthorn fought for handhold and foothold, raving at Torinaga to help, almost pulled down into the abyss. Still partially stunned, Torinaga hacked his toes into the face of the wall, and half-dragged and half-carried by Blackthorn, clawed his way out. They both lay gasping in safety. At that moment, there was another shock. The earth split again. Mariko screamed. She tried to scramble out of the way, but this new fissure swallowed her. Frantically, Blackthorn crawled for the edge, the aftershocks throwing him off balance. On the brink, he stared down. She shivered on a ledge a few feet below, as the ground reeled and the sky looked down. The chasm was 30 paces deep, 10 wide. The lip crumbled away under him, sickeningly. He let himself slide down, mud and stones almost blinding him, and caught hold of her, pulling her to the safety of another ledge. Together they fought for balance. A new shock. The ledge mostly gave way, and they were lost. Then Toranaga's iron hand caught his sash, stopping their slide into hell.
"For Christ's sake!"
Blackthorn cried, his arms almost torn from their sockets as he held onto her and fought for holds with his feet and free hand. Toranaga grappled him until they were on a narrow shelf again. Then the sash broke. A moment's respite from the tremors gave Blackthorn time to get her out onto the shelf, debris raining on them. Toranaga leapt to safety, shouting for him to hurry. The chasm howled and began to close, Blackthorn and Mariko still deep in its gullet. Toranaga could no longer help. Blackthorn's terror lent him inhuman strength, and somehow he managed to rip Mariko out of the tomb and shove her upward. Toranaga clutched her wrist and hauled her over the lip. Blackthorn scrambled after her, but reeled backward as part of his wall fell away. The far wall screeched sickeningly as it approached. Mud and stones tumbled off it. For a moment he thought he was trapped, but he tore himself free and groped half out of his grave. He lay on the shuddering brink, his lungs gulping air, unable to crawl away, legs in the cleft. The gap was closing. Then it stopped, 6 paces across the mouth, 8 deep. All rumbling ceased. The earth firmed. The silence gathered. On their hands and knees, helpless, they waited for the horror to begin again. Blackthorn started to get up, sweat dripping.
Iye!
Toranaga motioned him to stay down, his face a mess, a cruel gash on his temple where his head had smashed against a rock. They were all panting, their chests heaving, bile in their mouths. Guards were picking themselves up. Some began running toward Toranaga.
Iye!
He shouted.
Mate!
Wait. They obeyed and went down on their hands and knees again. The waiting seemed to go on forever. Then a bird screeched out of a tree and took to the air screaming. Another bird followed. Blackthorn shook his head to clear the sweat from his eyes. He was seeing his broken, bleeding fingernails gripping the tufts of grass. Then in the grass, an ant moved. Another and another. They began to forage. Still frightened, he sat back on his heels.
When's it safe?
Mariko did not answer. She was mesmerized by the cleft in the ground. He scrambled over to her.
Are you all right?
Yes, yes,
she said breathlessly. Her face was daubed with mud. Her kimono was ripped and filthy. Both sandals and one tabi were missing. And her parasol. He helped her away from the lip. She was still numbed. Then he looked at Toranaga.
Ikaga desu?
Toranaga was unable to speak, his chest grinding, his arms and legs raw with abrasions. He pointed. The fissure which had almost swallowed him now was just a narrow ditch in the soil. Northward, the ditch yawned into a ravine again, but it was not as wide as it once had been, nor as deep. Blackthorn shrugged.
Karma.
Toranaga belched loudly, then hawked and spat and belched again. This helped his voice to work, and a torrent of abuse poured over the ditch. His blunt fingers stabbed at it, and though Blackthorn could not understand all the words, Toranaga was clearly saying, as a Japanese would,
"The pox on the karma! The pox on the quake! The pox on the ditch! I've lost my swords, and the pox on that!"
Blackthorn burst into laughter, his relief at being alive and the stupidity of it all consuming him. A moment, then Toranaga laughed too, and their hilarity swept into Mariko. Toranaga got to his feet, gingerly. Then, warmed by the joy of life, he began clowning on the ditch, burlesquing himself and the quake. He stopped and beckoned Blackthorn to join him, and straddled the ditch, opened his loincloth, and after taking him again, told Blackthorn to do the same. Blackthorn obeyed, and both men tried to urinate into the ditch. But nothing came, not even a dribble. They tried very hard, which increased their laughter, and blocked them even more. At length, they succeeded, and Blackthorn sat down to collect his strength, leaning back on his hands. When he had recovered a little, he turned to Mariko.
"Is the earthquake over for good, Mariko-san?"
"Until the next shock, yes."
She continued to brush the mud off her hands and kimono. Is it always like that?
No. Sometimes it's very slight. Sometimes there's another series of shocks after a stick of time, or a day, or half a stick, or half a day. Sometimes there's only one shock. You never know, Anjin-san. It's over until it begins again. Karma, ne?
Guards were watching them without moving, waiting for Torunaga's order. To the north, fires were raging in the crude lean-to bivouac. Samurai were fighting the fires and digging at the rock avalanche to find the buried. To the east, Yabu, Ome, and Buntaro stood with other guards beside the far end of the fissure, untouched except for bruises, also waiting to be summoned. Igarashi had vanished. The earth had gorged on him. Blackthorn let himself drift. His self-contempt had vanished, and he felt utterly serene and whole. Now his mind dwelt proudly on being samurai, and going to Edo, and his ship, and war, and the black ship, and back to samurai again. He glanced at Torunaga, and would have liked to ask him a dozen questions, but he noticed that the daimyo was lost in his own thoughts, and he knew it would be impolite to disturb him.
There's plenty of time, he thought contentedly, and looked over at Mariko.
She was tending her hair and face, so he did not watch. He lay full length and looked up at the sky, the earth feeling warm on his back, waiting patiently. Torunaga spoke, serious now.
Domo, Anjin-san, ne?
Domo.
Dozo Torunaga-sama. Nani mo. Onbun, ne?
Please, Torunaga-sama. It was nothing. Duty. Then, not knowing enough words and wanting it accurate, Blackthorn said,
Mariko-san, would you explain for me? I seem to understand now what you meant, and Lord Torunaga meant, about karma, and the stupidity of worrying about what is. A lot seems clearer. I don't know why. Perhaps it's because I've never been so terrified. Maybe that's cleaned my head. But I seem to think clearer. It's, well, like old Gardner. Yes, that was all my fault, and I'm truly sorry. But that was a mistake, not a deliberate choice on my part. It is. So nothing can be done about it. A moment ago, we were all almost dead. So all that worry and heartache was a waste, wasn't it? Karma. Yes, I know karma now. Do you understand?
Yes.
She translated to Torunaga.
He says, good, Anjin-san. Karma is the beginning of knowledge. Next is patience. Patience is very important. The strong are the patient ones, Anjin-san. Patience means holding back your inclination to the seven emotions. Hate, adoration, joy, anxiety, anger, grief, fear. If you don't give way to the seven, you're patient. Then you'll soon understand all manner of things and be in harmony with eternity.
You believe that, Mariko-san?
Yes, very much. I try also to be patient, but it's hard.
I agree. That's also wa, your harmony, your tranquility, ne?
Yes.
Tell him I thank him truly for what he did for old Gardner. I didn't before, not from my heart. Tell him that.
There's no need, Anjin-san. He knew before that you were just being polite.
How did he know?
I told you, he is the wisest man in the world.
He grinned.
There, she said, your age has fallen off you again, and added in Latin, thou art thyself again, and better than before.
But thou art beautiful, as always.
Her eyes warmed, and she averted them from Torunaga. Blackthorn saw this and marked her caution. He got to his feet and stared down into the jagged cleft. Carefully he jumped into it and disappeared. Mariko scrambled up, momentarily afraid, but Blackthorn quickly came back to the surface. In his hands was Hujiko's sword. It was still scabbarded, though muddied and scarred. His short stabbing sword had disappeared. He knelt in front of Torunaga and offered his sword as a sword should be offered.
Dozo Torunaga-sama, he said simply.
Kara samurai, ni samurai, ne?
Please, Lord Toranaga, from a samurai to a samurai, eh?
Domo, Anjin-san.
The Lord of the Kanto accepted the sword and shoved it into his sash. Then he smiled, leaned forward, and clapped Blackthorn once on the shoulder, hard.
Domo, ne?
Friend, eh?
Domo.
Blackthorn glanced away. His smile faded. A cloud of smoke was drifting over the rise above where the village would be. At once he asked Toranaga if he could leave, to make sure Hujiko was all right.
He says, yes, Anjin-san, and we are to see him at the fortress at sunset for the evening meal. There are some things he wishes to discuss with you.
Blackthorn went back to the village. It was devastated. The course of the road bent out of recognition, the surface shattered. But the boats were safe. Many fires still burned. Villagers were carrying buckets of sand and buckets of water. He turned the corner. Omi's house was tilted drunkenly on its side. His own was a burnt-out ruin. Chapter 39. Hujiko had been injured. Nigatsu, her maid, was dead. The first shock had collapsed the central pillars of the house, scattering the coals of the kitchen fire. Hujiko and Nigatsu had been trapped by one of the fallen beams, and the flames had turned Nigatsu into a torch. Hujiko had been pulled free. One of the cook's children had also been killed, but the rest of his servants had suffered only bruises and some twisted limbs. They were all overjoyed to find that Blackthorn was alive and unhurt. Hujiko was lying on a salvaged futon near the undamaged garden fence, half conscious. When she saw also that Blackthorn was unscathed, she almost wept.
I thank Buddha you're not hurt, Anshin-san, she said weakly.
Still partially in shock, she tried to get up, but he bade her not to move. Her legs and lower back were badly burned. A doctor was already tending her, wrapping bandages soaked in char and other herbs around her limbs to soothe them. Blackthorn hid his concern and waited until the doctor had finished, then said privately,
Hujiko-san, Yoika?
Lady Fujiko will be all right? The doctor shrugged.
Hai.
His lips came back from his protruding teeth again.
Kama, ne?
Hai.
Blackthorn had seen enough burned seamen die to know that any bad burn was dangerous, the open wound almost always rotting within a few days, and nothing to stop the infection spreading.
I don't want her to die.
Dozo?
He said it in Japanese, and the doctor shook his head and told him that the lady would surely be all right. She was young and strong.
Shikata ga nai,
the doctor said, and ordered maids to keep her bandages moist, gave Blackthorn herbs for his own abrasions, told him he would return soon, then scuttled up the hill toward Omi's wrecked house above. Blackthorn stood at his main gate, which was unharmed. Buntaro's arrows were still embedded in the left post. Absently, he touched one.
Karma that she was burned,
he thought sadly. He went back to Hujiko and ordered the maid to bring cha. He helped her to drink and held her hand until she slept, or appeared to sleep. His servants were salvaging whatever they could, working quickly, helped by a few villagers. They knew the rains would be coming soon. Four men were trying to erect a temporary shelter.
Doso, Anjin-san.
The cook was offering him fresh tea, trying to keep the misery off his face. The little girl had been his favorite daughter.
Domo,
Blackthorn replied.
Sumimasen.
I'm sorry.
Arigato, Anjin-san.
Kama, ne?
Blackthorn nodded, accepted the tea, and pretended not to notice the cook's grief, lest he shame him. Later, a samurai came up the hill, bringing word from Toranaga that Blackthorn and Hujiko were to sleep in the fortress until the house was rebuilt. Two palanquins arrived. Blackthorn lifted her gently into one of them and sent her with maids. He dismissed his own palanquin, telling her he'd follow soon. The rain began, but he paid it no heed. He sat on a stone in the garden that had given him so much pleasure. Now it was a shambles. The little bridge was broken, the pond shattered, and the streamlet had vanished.
Never mind,
he said to no one.
The rocks aren't dead.
Yuikiya had told him that a garden must be settled around its rocks, that without them, a garden is empty, merely a place of growing. One of the rocks was jagged and ordinary, but Yuikiya had planted it so that if you looked at it long and hard near sunset, the reddish glow glinting off the veins and crystal buried within, you could see a whole range of mountains with lingering valleys and deep lakes, and far off, a greening horizon, night gathering there. Blackthorn touched the rock.
"I name you Yuikiya-sama," he said.
This pleased him, and he knew that if Yuikiya were alive, the old man would have been very pleased also.
"Even though he's dead, perhaps he'll know," Blackthorn told himself. "Perhaps his kami is here now." Shintoists believed that when they died, they became a kami. "What is a kami, Mariko-san?"
"Kami is inexplicable, Anjin-san. It is like a spirit, but not. Like a soul, but not. Perhaps it is the insubstantial essence of a thing or person. You should know a human becomes a kami after death, but a tree or rock or plant or painting is equally a kami. Kami are venerated, never worshipped. They exist between heaven and earth and visit this land of the gods or leave it, all at the same time."
"And Shinto? What's Shinto?"
"Ah, that is inexplicable too. So sorry. It's like a religion, but isn't. At first, it even had no name. We only called it Shinto, the way of the kami, 1,000 years ago, to distinguish it from Butsudo, the way of Buddha. But though it's indefinable, Shinto is the essence of Japan and the Japanese. And though it possesses neither theology, nor godhead, nor faith, nor system of ethics, it is our justification for existence. Shinto is a nature cult of myths and legends, in which no one believes wholeheartedly, yet everyone venerates totally. A person is Shinto, in the same way he is born Japanese."
"Are you Shinto too, as well as Christian?"
"Oh yes, oh very yes, of course."
Blackthorn touched the stone again.
"Please, kami of Yuikiya, please stay in my garden."
Then, careless of the rain, he let his eyes take him into the rock, past the lush valleys and serene lake, and to the greening horizon, darkness gathering there. His ears told him to come back. He looked up. Omi was watching him, squatting patiently on his haunches. It was still raining, and Omi wore a newly pressed kimono under his rice straw raincoat, and a wide conical bamboo hat. His hair was freshly shampooed.
"Kama, Anjin-san,"
he said, motioning at the smouldering ruins.
"Hai, ikaga desu ka?"
Blackthorn wiped the rain off his face.
"Yoi."
Omi pointed up at his house.
"Watakushi no yuya wa hakai sarete imasen otsukai ni narimasen ka?"
"My bath wasn't damaged. Would you care to use it?"
"Ah, so des. Domo, Omi-san. Hai, domo."
Gratefully, Blackthorn followed Omi up the winding path into his courtyard. Servants and village artisans under Mura's supervision were already hammering and sawing and repairing. The central posts were already back in place, and the roof almost resettled. With signs and simple words and much patience, Omi explained that his servants had managed to douse the fires in time.
"Within a day or two," he told Blackthorn, "the house would be up again, as good as it was, so not to worry. Yours will take longer, a week, Anjin-san. Don't worry, Fujiko-san is a fine manager. She'll have all costs arranged with Mura in no time, and your house will be better than ever. I hear she was burned. Well, this happens sometimes, but not to worry. Our doctors are very expert with burns. They have to be, eh?" "Yes, Anjin-san, it was a bad quake, but not that bad. The rice fields were hardly touched, and the so essential irrigation system was undamaged. And the boats weren't damaged, and that's very important, too. Only 154 samurai were killed in the avalanche. That's not too many, eh? As to the village, a week, and you'll hardly know there was a quake. 5 peasants were killed, and a few children. Nothing. And Jiro